Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Yitz, Toto. Welcome to episode 74 of the Commentary Track, also known sometimes as the Ale and Quail Club. I'm your downtrodden host, Frank Thompson, and I welcome you to another good conversation, this one with Preston Sturges' son, Tom Sturges. As regular listeners of this podcast know, and yes, I'm talking to both of you, there are several directors whom I hold in high regard. William Wellman, Howard Hawks, Sam Peckinpah, John Ford, Jean Renoir, many others. There are many others that I really like. But in the top tier of my director's pantheon stands Preston Sturges. I have admired his work as a director and writer since I first encountered them when I was in college, I guess. And my admiration just grows the more and more I see. Now, Sturges started out as a playwright, then started writing screenplays, and wrote some darn good ones, and then became a director in 1940. After he directed his first film in 1940, he had an unbroken string of hits that went straight to 1944, and they are Christmas in July, The Great McGinty, Sullivan's Travels, The Lady Eve, The Palm Beach Story, The Great Moment, not a hit, Hail the Conquering Hero, and then he made a deal with the devil, well, Howard Hughes, and made The Sin of Harold Diddlebach, or Mad Wednesday, as it was also known, and then made Unfaithfully Yours at Fox and The Beautiful Blonde from Bashful Bend. Neither one of those last two did particularly well at the box office, although Unfaithfully Yours is a really interesting movie. His career was short, and his son Tom talks with me about some of the reasons why that was so, but I'm not one of those people who say poor Preston Sturges because he shone so brightly and then his career ended pretty quickly thereafter. What I say is he made six or seven indelible masterpieces, and you can think of very, very few directors who can say the same thing. And plus, when you count the scripts that he wrote that others directed, such as Remember the Night, The Power and the Glory, and Diamond Jim, and so many terrific movies that others directed, then it really puts Sturges in a class, if not completely by himself, at least in an unusual position of having directed and written so many terrific and great films. His son Tom, who did not know his father really well, he died when Tom was only three, which is the same age that Davy Crockett killed him a bar, just parenthetically. Tom has become a student of his dad and knows a whole lot about him, and because he talked a lot with his mom about his father, has a great deal of insight into what kind of man he was. Tom is an incredibly impressive guy himself. He was a music executive. He's an author, a speaker. He's got a new book coming out called Every Idea is a Good Idea. And he's doing a book signing at Book Soup this coming Friday, September 26, 2014. I hope that you will all go down and buy a book and get him to sign it and listen to his talk. We do spend a little bit of time talking about that. And there's also a terrific movie that he was a part of, because he was part of a mentoring program for some disadvantaged kids and turned them into a choir and really changed their lives in a lot of ways. So that's also a movie to look out for, and he talks a little bit about it in our conversation. And naturally, on the website page for Tom Sturges, you'll see Amazon links to his books, to his dad's films, to his own films, and I'll link his websites and his Twitter and all the relevant stuff, because this is a guy you'll want to know more about. And let's learn more about him right now. Enjoy my conversation with Tom Sturges. See you on the other side. How well do you remember him, if at all?
I actually have almost zero memories of my dad. He died when I was 3, and since we're sitting here with a 5-year-old, I know for a fact that they don't remember much.
Yeah.
They get little glimpses, but for the most part, everything I know about him, I learned.
Yeah. So when did you become aware of who he was?
I remember going to a film class in college, and I was sort of the invited special guest, and I got up and made a couple of remarks about him and realized that I'd left that audience very hungry because they were there studying the hows and whys of his work and what he was able to create, and I knew very, very little about him. But I could see there was 150 people sitting there who were dying to know more. I remember going to a festival of his films. And that was a big deal. I think it was at the New Art. It was like a Preston Sturges film every Friday for 8 weeks. And it was like a doubleheader. And all these films, somebody had gone to all the trouble of tracking them down. And I realized, wow, there's a lot of devotees here.
You could cover just about his entire career in that amount of time, right?
You could.
Yeah.
And if anybody who was at this event remembers, here's the true story. So it was a screening of Remember the Night. And this was long before DVDs, and there were rough versions. These films were tattered in some cases. But nonetheless, we get to this beautiful, beautiful film, Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck. Again, she's a crook, but a brilliant one. And the film, we get to the last reel, and the last few hundred yards of the last reel. And that white spot appears at the center of the film. Mm-hmm. And we know that the film is about to die. And screen goes to white, and I hear the audience groan, oh no. And I'm sitting there in a packed theater, the New Art, absolutely full. And a few minutes later, the lensman comes down, the projector. What is the projector man?
Projectionist
comes down and says, ladies and gentlemen, I have bad news. There's not even enough film to wrap through the whole camera, so this is all we're going to get. And I hear the whole audience just groaning, groaning. Now, pause, footnote. I had never seen this movie. I had only heard about it, never actually seen the movie my whole life. And I stood up as though pushed from behind, and I said, perhaps I could be of some assistance. And the whole room kind of looks at me, and I said, and somebody calls out and says, well, who are you, who are you? And I said, well, I'm Tom Sturges. I'm Preston Sturges' son. And if it's okay with everybody, I'll tell you how the movie ends. Having not seen the movie before, but I figured my dad would forgive me because I was giving them what they wanted, namely a proper end to the film they had been sitting there for the last 70 minutes. So I made up several new nuances and threw them out there. And I said, but at the end, they hold each other in a long embrace and kiss, knowing that someday they'll see each other again. And to a smattering of applause, I sat down. But
well,
it was kind of fun.
That comes pretty close.
I think he would have wanted the movie to at least have an ending so that everybody who walked out of there would go, ah. It would sort of be like hearing a piano player go, do re mi fa so la ti. Play that last note, buddy. Come on.
That actually happened. There's a film festival called CineCon every year that plays mostly silent and early sound films. But it was Labor Day weekend, and just last week, whenever that was, the last note of the film, of the VN title, went. So it went, bam, bam, and without prompting, the audience went, bam.
Like shaving a quarter, right?
Yeah.
Da, 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 dee, da. Right, Roger
like,
Rabbit.
Like what next? Yeah.
So. I did in one other thing. I worked with the people at UCLA and 20th Century Fox, and we preserved The Power and the Glory. And this film was a real mess. There were sections. The full master had portions that were in French, portions that were green, and portions that just the beginning and the ending weren't there. If ever a film, and it's a wonderful, wonderful
sure
picture,
it is, yeah.
If ever a film needed a preservation, it was this one. And what we also were able to find in the files at UCLA in our, the library that we donated was the score. And so we find this one scene that's in the score that's not in the movie, not in any of the versions of the movie, and it's called The Autograph. And we go and look to the script, and there's a note in the script that says The Autograph, and it's where Tom, the main character, signs his name to the bottom of a document for the first time he's ever done this. And we looked around and we couldn't, nobody could find it. We couldn't find the original version, so they decided to shoot it again. And so I actually get to star in one of my dad's films.
Wow.
But only from about 2 inches above the wrist down to my fingers.
So you're Spencer Tracy's hand?
I am Spencer Tracy's hand.
Wow.
In this. And you can see, and there, and the guy who created the music, I wish I could remember his name. He did a great job. And he created this, and you hear, boom, boom. So I had to try and do my my signature. So in the preserved version of The Power and the Glory, there's
wow,
this, and they got me an old jacket, and we found an old pen and an old inkwell, like everything. Jumping back in time for those couple of minutes.
That's terrific. I haven't seen that film in so long, and now I have a new reason to see it because it's wonderful. William K. Howard directed it.
Yes.
The great Colleen Moore, one of her last films, unfortunately.
So. Oh.
So,
And not supposedly, although if Peter Bogdanovich is listening, you know, we can meet at a bar later and discuss this. This is a template for Citizen Kane that many people believe is the, you might even say, the rough outline. And somewhere in my dad's files, there's a letter from Joseph Mankiewicz asking for a copy of the script.
Wow.
So there's
so that backs that up a little bit.
Yeah, there's reason to believe that the creators of one were able to, had seen the other.
Well, a lot of people have written about that and talked about it, and certainly I've... There are elements there, absolutely.
Let's see. The story of a great industrialist who can never get over an act of betrayal.
Yeah.
Who, at the very last moment of his life, looks to his innocence and his past. Random use of time. Story told in a very, very different way than anybody had ever told before. The templates of the films are very, very similar. The random use of time, very similar. The story of a great industrialist and how he was brought down by the industry he created. And then the betrayal. You know, the betrayal at the end. You know, the man dying of a broken heart. And in The Power and the Glory, and I'm not going to say what happens, but you know what happens.
Sure.
He finds out that his betrayal is so deep and so thorough that it's he can't even face life knowing that that has been done to him. I mean, an astonishing film.
It's really a great film. I often look at the films that your father wrote but didn't direct, and especially Remember the Night, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And I often wonder what would he have done had he directed them? How different would they be? Because he was always dissatisfied, especially with Mitchell Leeson. He seems to have really disliked Leeson's take on all of his stuff. But
I think it was
Remember the Night is so great.
Right.
I can't imagine what he would have done differently.
I think the analogy is the songwriter who becomes the artist.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what it was. My dad was the songwriter when he was just writing the scripts. And there's If I Were King, which is an amazing little work all by itself. And then Remember the Night. I love Remember the Night. There's a scene, almost a ballet in Remember the Night where
Fred
McMurray's mom is encouraging Barbara Stanwyck to stay out of his life.
Yeah.
He's had this beautiful life. And it dawns on Barbara Stanwyck at the same time it dawns on us that she's being encouraged to get out.
Yeah.
But in the nicest possible way. And only at the end of the scene do you realize, oh my, what she just said to him.
Yeah.
You know, so moving. But like I was saying, he was a songwriter who gradually realized that he would rather sing his own sing his own songs. And I think the Mitchell, you pronounce it Leeson. I've always heard it as Leeson, but you say Leeson.
I don't. Let's call the whole thing off.
Leeson. I think he felt that he lingered on the stationary objects way too much. Like the set was a star in a Mitchell Leeson film.
Ah.
You know, and you see, what is the movie with the Bull of Broad Street? What is that film? Easy Living.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Easy Living. The set, literally the set takes, if you take all the time where they're like that sweeping camera view, like, okay, enough. The hotel, is it the Hotel Louis?
Yeah, oh, where the mink coat film comes out the window.
Such a famous scene, such an iconic scene, and so many people remember it and, you know, can't seem to forget it.
Yeah. Well, Leeson was known as a stylist in a way. I mean, his films always had a certain gloss to them that your father's films didn't have, at least that wasn't the predominant reason for them. If they did have beauty in them, that was simply to serve the story.
Right. Well, he does that in Sullivan's Travels when they finally get to Sullivan's house. There are some long sweeping views of, and Joel McRae's going, well, here's the living room, and, and here's this, and here's that. And she's like, well, where's the pool? All you big directors have a big pool. And then she pushes them in, and, you know, that sweet scene.
Your father wrote The Great McGinty, and as I understand it, didn't he go to Paramount and say, I'll direct this for free, or I'll sell you the script for nothing?
It was
for a dollar or something.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about it because this all came out as these other films were. He was writing all these other films and getting paid an incredible amount of money. I mean, 1937, making $4,000 a week.
Yeah, I could live on that now. Believe me,
there are people who could. You could feed a small family on $4,000 a week.
Yeah.
So he's making incredible money, giving them hits. And he kept saying, but I want to direct this one, I want to direct. And they kept saying the same thing back. Writers write, directors direct. So he came to them with a movie. It was called Biography of a Bum. And he said, this isn't your movie. This is my movie. I wrote it at home on my own time. But I will sell it to you for a dollar if you let me direct it. And after some deliberation, they came back and they said, well, the legal department doesn't feel like a dollar. It doesn't sound right, so we'd like to offer you $10. This is Paramount.
That was
Pictures.
Generous.
$10. So, what did they think he was going to say? He was like, okay. and started, you know, that started something that has never stopped.
Yeah.
You know, the writer directing his own film. And so when people ask me, why is your dad famous? I say, well, that's probably one of the reasons. He's the first time a writer directed his own work. Not Charlie Chaplin, not those kind of, that's a different thing, but an actual, like a screenwriter coming up through the ranks and earning the right to direct his own film and changing the way, from my standpoint, you know, not that I'm an expert in any way, but from my standpoint, changing the way films get made because it recognizes the auteur. Who used to be just the director? It used to be the director was the auteur. He was the power. He was the, as my dad called it in his autobiography, he was considered a prince of the blood. And this related back to the days when the director was the storyteller. The director was considered the storyteller. And then with people like my dad making those kind of scripts and taking over that power, and then that final step in directing his own words really changed everything. And you know, all the auteurs now, you think if it didn't say written and directed by, there's no Spike Lee, there's no Woody Allen, there's no several others who have enjoyed that privilege.
Yeah. And when I was young and starting to study film, the auteur theory meant a lot to me because I didn't know any better. But I soon realized that it doesn't hold that much water throughout film history. But in the case of your dad, it does. Because really every element of a Preston Sturges film comes from Preston Sturges. There's no doubt about that. You can watch it. You can see his touch. You can hear his language. And it's all there. The way the, you know, we were talking earlier about how would Remember the Night be different. All you have to do is watch The Lady Eve or Palm Beach Story and see the way the people move and see the gestures they make and see the looks they give each other. And that's the difference. That's directing.
Right.
You know?
My dad would talk about going to the Yiddish theaters in New York during the mid to late 20s and watching this fantastic comedy unfold. But he also noticed the fact that the audience always looked at the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? Like their eyes were always like it was a group experience as people all looked over here and all looked over there. And that made its way into his directing of his films. Like the camera is, it's a motion picture. That camera's almost always moving.
Yeah.
And he had to invent a system where they had a dolly to where they were in Miracle of Morgan's Creek, where they were walking down the street. So the use of the camera and the way that point of view was developed through his work is really extraordinary. I wanted to mention one other thing you said, because yes, he worked totally on his own and, you know, the auteur, and let everybody know that he did it too, apparently, and pissed a lot of people
yes.
off. Pissed a lot of people off. But according to Eddie Bracken, whose story this is, my dad was always looking for another laugh. Never a joke. And I don't know if anybody's noticed this in my dad's films. There is not one joke.
No.
Everybody is dead serious about what they're doing. So when Eddie Bracken is standing up and he's trying to pretend to be Norville Ratsky, he is dead serious trying to pull off this thing. And when she says, "My name is Trudy Cockenlocker," nobody's telling. And even you think about Bill Demarest and that beautiful character that he was able to create and nuance over many of the films. He was considered my dad's good luck charm. But he was always a mean, surly son of a bitch. And whether it was... And what was he talking about when his like younger daughter in Miracle of Morgan's Creek, she's always testing him.
Yeah.
And he says, maybe I should just take care of you with this hatchet. The mystery of Morgan's Creek. I mean, he was just, all they'll find is your hair ribbon and and an axe. I mean, but this guy was so deadly serious. But slipping back into this other idea, my dad would pay a dollar for a laugh. If anybody on set came up with a better word or a better moment. And there's a scene, and Eddie Bracken tells the story. There's a scene in Miracle of Morgan's Creek where he's on the deck speaking to William Demarest. And William Demarest is telling him that you got to take her to the... He knows what's happened. He knows all her developments. He says, you got to take her to the theater and you got to snuggle up. That's what you really got to snuggle up. And Eddie Bracken says, snuggle. And Bill Demarest is cleaning his gun mm-hmm. through this whole scene. Like, and he's just finally, he locks the gun and he looks through the thing. And he asks himself a question. He says, there isn't any idiocy in your family in there. And then he's talking to him, and they hadn't told my dad that they were going to do this. But they took the screen door and they put the tacks in, like, the loosest possible version of the tacks in. So there's Bill Demarest, and he shoots the gun into the floor, and Eddie Bracken is supposed to just, like, soil himself at the mm-hmm. sound. And you see him walking in, and he does it, but he walks right through the screen door. Right, and it was a laugh that they hadn't told the set guys hadn't told. Nobody had told the director we're going to do this. We're just going to try. And you can actually see the dolly he's on. You can see the shot shaking afterward on that take because it was such a big laugh for you to get. The gun goes boom. I understand, sir. And then like walks through a screen door. It was just. And he got it. He said he earned a dollar for coming up with that.
See, I would have bet anything that he'd come up with that gag. So, right. So there you go. I think that might be, well, sometimes it's my favorite Preston Sturges film. Maybe it's just the last Preston Sturges film I saw is my favorite. So, but that one is way up there. But I do, I'm on record as saying this, you can check at the courthouse. The script to the Palm Beach Story, I think line for line, is the funniest script anybody ever wrote. Mm. I think just reading it right off the page, Every line is perfect.
It's such a genius piece of work, that script. Because again, the subjects that it touches on, right? Because I, by the way, my dad was a very jealous man in his love life, and I know this because my mom, I guess my dad had been dead probably 20 years or something. My mom and I were sitting around having a coffee, and I asked her, I said, "So what was the toughest thing about Daddy? Right? What was the toughest thing to live with?" And she goes, "Oh, his jealousy." And just as though something had just happened. I said, "Well, what kind of stuff?" She said, if they were at the Players and a waiter, particularly somebody close to her age, made her laugh, and my dad noticed it, he would descend into a black rage that would last the rest of the night.
Gee.
And there are people who are like this. This is a fact of some people's lives. John Lennon is one of these same people. I don't know if you noticed, like almost all his songs in the early days were all, they're jealous. They are. I'm a jealous guy.
And Run for Your Life, if you can, Run for Your Life is a frightening song. You know?
Yeah, but it takes a jealous man to think of it, and a jealous man to try and turn it into a toony little thing.
Yeah.
So
it's a song about threatening to kill his girlfriend if she doesn't. Yeah. It's
again.
A bouncing little melody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, set to a nice snappy beat.
Yeah.
Well, it was just part of the thing. Just part of who he was, I guess.
Yeah.
And the Palm Beach story is the story of a jealous man. The character Tom, who I'm named after, the first jealousy that he has to get over is the Weenie King.
Sure.
Well, who's this Weenie King? So finally I get to see what's going on around here. Right? And he's just instantly jealous. Who did this? Who said that to you? Right? I mean, but ultimately, that's the beauty of the story, is you see this jealous man and what happens to him, because everybody he's jealous about. And when he's finally confronted with the guy who wants to not only take his wife away, but marry her and put her up in the style to which she could easily grow accustomed, he gets in business with the guy.
Yeah.
So I thank you on behalf of my dad. I thank you for that compliment. And I think it is a tremendous, tremendous script. And I love Toto.
Oh, yeah.
Nitz Toto is just whoever that brilliant comedian. I don't know who that guy is. Nitz to yourself, Toto.
And the film just has a structure like no other film, because it actually ends with the end of another movie. Basically,
yes,
is what it does.
He's done that twice.
It's just,
and they lived happily ever after. And then big musical. I don't know what chord. That's like a triple diminished flat seventh disaster chord, like when the train stops chord. And it says, "Or did they?" And they lived happily ever after. Or did they? And then you see the movie, and he never explains that opening.
No,
he never explains what maid is doing in the closet. Who got married?
Yes.
Who didn't know they were a twin? I mean, it's just unbelievable. And then at the end, oh, you're a twin?
Yeah. And by the end, you've forgotten about it.
Of course. And then they repeat the scene.
Yeah. Oh, and then it comes right back.
It must have been for him during those days, if you think about it. And I think the Beatles enjoyed this very much, too, that they had a progression of hits that they gave them a creative momentum that allowed them to just go with instinct.
Yeah.
And this must have been what it was like for my dad, to have a hit in the theaters, a hit on its way out, and you're shooting a hit.
Yeah.
And you want this, and you're running your restaurant, and you're sleeping with a lot of different women and drinking a lot, and I mean, and life is rich and beautiful. And then this all preserves itself into movie making. And he told the story about making The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, which is still, most people can't believe that in the days of the Hayes office, where they were saying, well, you know, you can't show that scene in the bedroom because the woman has to have her foot on the floor. You know, I mean, like, oh, no, you have to button her, that you can almost see the shadow of her right breast. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had to go back and reshoot these scenes. It was just the stupidest thing. Yet here's a story about a girl who gets pregnant out of wedlock, and she's the star of the movie.
Yeah. And it's essentially a virgin birth. I mean, it's not only, it's not only that she's pregnant, but that they are doing a kind of burlesque of the Christmas story. Ratsky is this who knows what he is.
Or where he is.
Yeah.
Right? And they show it in some Christmas film festivals. Bruce Goldstein at the Film Forum in New York, who's the most amazing supportive fan of my dad. I love that guy. He's been tremendous, keeping my dad's whole story name alive. He shows it sometimes in the Christmas
as well
films.
He should,
absolutely.
Yeah. I want to go back to music a little bit, because one thing that's always struck me about your dad, I have no good explanation for it, maybe you do, is more than any director I can think of, he uses music. He'll pull these old sentimental, almost jokingly sentimental songs, like Hearts and Flowers kind of songs, and use them without any irony at all. And he does this fairly frequently. That kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always struck by that, because it's anybody else using that stuff would be using it in a parodistic sense.
Mm.
But he doesn't.
Well, he's not making you... I go back to this other idea. My perception only. Nobody said this to me. Everybody is dead serious in his films.
Yeah.
And there is no clowning. There is zero clowning.
And he doesn't clown about them. That's the...
There's no clowning.
The point about the music.
There's no clowning in the music. When he wants to make you weep, he puts a song like Home to the Arms of Mother and a bunch of Marines snuffling into their beer. Why? Because he wants you to feel that way. I mean, it's... And some of the... I don't know who the music partner was, but I think he had a... He loved classical music. I think if you see Unfaithfully Yours, you get a sense of how much he enjoyed classical music. And it was like lovemaking watching those orchestra scenes. I mean, you could just see him sticking the camera in these places and going, play! And when the guy gets out the big cymbals, right, there's a cymbal the size of a small car.
Sure.
Right, does he... and falls off the back. I mean, it's really... So I think music is just one more element. Edith Head made most of the costumes. Not a lot of people remember, but the Lady Eve started a whole fashion trend, and you were wearing the Lady Eve dresses, and if you look at Barbara Stanwyck in that movie, she was so unbelievably beautiful and stylish and was able to slip between the sofa and the end table after Henry Fonda, stumbles over a sofa. I mean, it was really something. This is the concept of what it must have been like to write the Palm Beach story with a movie in the theaters and a movie coming out, and you're making a movie, and just the up-tempo of life and what that must have been like for him. The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, we got off on sort of the Hayes office and all the restrictions that they made. When they gave him the right to make that film, it was a hole in the production schedule. Another movie had dropped off, and they had only 4 or 5 weeks, and they had a space where they could make The Miracle of Morgan's Creek. And they didn't have the finished script, so they sent the rough script to the Hayes office and said, we're jumping in. And then what my dad did as he was making that film, he was staying about 40 to 50 pages ahead. So they only had 40 pages when they started that film. And that is a complicated story that jumps up, and there are lies in the beginning that better show up at the end and get resolved. So he was shooting the film during the day and coming back to his office at night and writing the next 10 pages, 40 pages ahead. Can you imagine what the thrill that must have been to when you finally hit the... And then go back to the players at night, have a couple of drinks with your friends, and then head back home. Home was 1917 Ivar, right where the Hollywood Freeway is now. But I think about those days as halcyon days for him, where it was rich of intellect, rich of beauty, rich of respect. And because of that momentum, he was able to make those films.
Yeah.
And you take that momentum away, and you put him the next chapter, Howard Hughes, and this kind of disastrous partnership. And then 20th Century Fox, where I think the whole alcoholism issue started to really raise their heads when he was there. But he didn't have... He got offered a job at 20th Century Fox by Daryl Zanuck that had he taken that gig, I mean, it would be a different life. He was asked to be the head of comedy for 20th Century Fox and not only make his own movies but help these other guys make their movies and let them bring him the scripts and let him touch him up and everything else. And if you think about that, like that role in the early 50s and how that could have blossomed into television, right around the corner, right there, and he rejected. He was like, no, I don't want to help other people with their make their movies. I want to make my movies. And he made two flops. He made the Beautiful Blonde from Bashful Bend and took some hottie, right, Betty Grable, mm-hmm. put her in a long dress. And it's like, what were you thinking? And then Unfaithful Yours about a man who wants to kill his wife.
Yeah. Another movie about jealousy, about intense jealousy. Yeah.
That he said in some interview that that was the closest to him. And you look at how insane that movie gets, all based on jealousy. Yeah. It was almost my dad's treatise on how jealousy. And personally, my own self, because I was for many years, I was a jealous boy. And then I heard this great, great phrase that somebody said. And for any jealous men who are listening, just listen to this next sentence. Jealousy is a poison you take hoping someone else will die.
True enough.
Right? And you take that poison. But it's almost like falling in love. You can't help it. If you walk into a creepy building in there and you hear a door slam upstairs, you get chills up and down your spine. You cannot control that. If you fall in love, just like Woody Allen said, the heart loves who it loves. You fall in love with that person. You can't make yourself stop in the same way that you can't make yourself love somebody either.
Sure.
It doesn't work that way. And jealousy is that same thing. And it's a terrible. Motivated so much of what men have done in romances and everything else. And like we're talking about, what, three films of my dad's based on this, a guy who's just so possessive about something. So.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the reason that your dad was really the total filmmaker for that period, was that he was able to filter in his own personality so directly into so many of these characters. This is
and as well, I think what he did a very good thing. The Great Sturgis Acting Company is something that a lot of his fans probably are familiar with, these same 11
sure.
individuals who show up in every film. And there was a wonderful logic that Eddie Bracken told me, the reason why they did that. And it was because of the union rules. That if you were only an extra in a film, you got paid for that 1 week, that whole week, because you were an extra. But if you got a line in the film, you got paid for the whole time the film was being shot. So if you look at a lot of those characters, Morgan, is it Frank Morgan, the boxer?
No,
Frank Moran.
No, Moran, yeah.
Frank Moran. And he has one line in every movie. He means a dray, he says in The Lady Eve, in The Great McGinty. That's what I told him. Right? He gets one line, but he gets paid for 8 weeks. He's on the set the whole time. He hangs around. He drives my dad to the restaurant and back. And he was a former heavyweight champion. So nobody messed with Frank Moran. So that's how my dad took care. And also because of the way he grew up in Europe and filled with interesting people, and he loved to hear people mangle English. None of his wives, by the way, but in his friendships and in the characters in his films, and you hear these guys who just are brutal to what they do with the language, and he who laughs last, laughs last. You know, just these brilliant, brilliant. Or Toto, the guy in the Pompey
sure.
story. Nitz Toto.
Yeah, what in the world is
what
his...
What is that word?
Yeah. What is his nationality? We just don't know.
If my little boy is trying to complain about something, I look over at him and I go, pish tush. Which I think comes from Christmas in July. Yeah. Another amazing, amazing film.
It really is. it's, I think one of the amazing things about your father is that he just has this unbroken string. And then when it stops, it stops.
The saddest.
It's really tragic. But on the other hand, that string of wonderful masterpieces, I mean, there really are. More than I ever did. So, I mean, you know, just the fact that he didn't go any farther than that is tragic to us, and I'm sure it was tragic to him.
He turned down the life preservers that were thrown his way.
Yeah.
He could have handled the Howard Hughes thing a lot better. And, you know, had he been able to sell it better. And I'm sure when they were just two guys getting drunk at the Players, hey, let's start making movies together. And Howard Hughes said, but I own 51%. And I'm sure my dad slapped him on the back and said, sure thing, Howie, or whatever, not realizing that was the end of the deal. Or Daryl Zanuck saying, come here and be head of comedy. Put your touch on all these other people's movies. I mean, talk about a life preserver. That's like a life preserver with a martini shaker on it. No. Why don't you just get out of your own way and say yes to something like that? So, and I think when my dad, when he bumped out of Hollywood, and I think he left in 51 or 52, and there were tax issues, and he was chasing deals in London and Paris, which is when I showed up, and he made a pretty terrible film called The French They Are a Funny Race. So he sort of had four stiffs in a row, something Johnny Depp better watch out. It's a bad number to have four in a row. It's hard to get out from under the weight of all those seats that have fallen on you. Jim Carrey, you got to really be so careful when, you know, as you reinvent, that you don't put yourself in a difficult situation like my dad did. However, I do want to point out that there are some iconic films that I believe are based exactly on his works. We talked about The Power and the Glory and Citizen Kane. Closer than cousins. Like, you wouldn't let those two get married.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? That would be... But there's another film my dad made. It was the film he made with Howard Hughes called Mad Wednesday or The Sin of Harold Dittelbach.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tell me if this reminds you of another movie. We have a guy who, at the beginning of the movie, goes through a life-changing event, stumbles into a bar, is given something to drink by a bartender who says, "Sir, you bring out the artist in me." Wakes up 24 hours later and now has to try and put his life back together and figure out what happened in the day that he missed. Okay? And he wakes up to find out that he's married. He wakes up to find out that he owns a circus and he has a lion in his living room. And of course everything magically works out, da da da. It sounds...
If there were three of them,
yeah,
you could almost make a Hangover movie.
It is The Hangover. That is precisely The Hangover.
And even with a lion, although it's not a lion in that case, is it?
No, it's a tiger.
Tiger, yeah.
But it is so precisely that film. And, you know, listen, if that was the film that they took as their inspiration, right, and they went, wow, this is... But there was nothing. My dad and Howard Hughes, in addition to screwing up their business together, they screwed up their copyright. Nobody preserved that copyright. It slipped into the public domain. But it's so obviously the blueprint for that film.
Sure.
So my dad lives on in his own spectacular way, you know.
He might have considered Sin of Harold Dittelbach as an unsuccessful film. But I don't. I think it's funny and poignant in the way that your dad could be poignant, because he almost always had dead serious moments in even the funniest of his comedies. As you were talking about, the characters are always take themselves seriously, and he takes them seriously, but there are always moments of genuine drama in those films.
In The Lady Eve, you watch this guy get ripped off for $32,000. You're like, hilarious. This is fantastic. Or the guy in the Christmas in July, if you can't sleep at night, it isn't the coffee, it's the bunk. Worst slogan ever
sure.
created. But nonetheless, you you can laugh at that guy believing so earnestly that that was the slogan that was going to change everything. I mean, the fact that he believes in it is what makes it so hilarious. And the problem with The Great Moment is it's a film ultimately about pain.
Yeah.
You know, Triumph Over... Oh, I think it was called Triumph Over Pain for a long time. And then they just didn't know what to do with it. He left Paramount. Another idiocy. Oh, what an act of idiocy. He insisted... In his contract that was paying him $7,000 a week, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
He insisted that 30 days after the release of any of his film, he have the right to opt out of his films if he didn't like the way Paramount marketed the film.
Gee.
and when I saw some correspondence between him and his lawyers, and I was like, what are you thinking? Right, but what he was trying to do, if you look back, if you take you know, high enough and look down, he was trying to control the marketing machine around his films because he didn't like the way, I think it was actually The Great Moment, he didn't like the way that film had been presented to the public. And maybe somebody edited it some series of disasters took place. And he was trying to control a system that you weren't supposed to control and turned his back on like the place he'd been making movies for 10 years. He'd been making movies at Paramount and
yeah.
Knew everybody, the cameramen, the guys in the commissary, the guys who clean up his office at night. I mean, crazy. So he turned down his own life preservers. He made his fortune. He lost his fortune. Had he not lived exactly the life he lived, I wouldn't be sitting here. So I don't bemoan it for me. I bemoan it for him. That he chose to bring unhappiness to his own life.
Yeah. Do you suppose that it was that incredible success for that period of time, that roughly, 7 or 8 years, that he is just winner after winner after winner, and people love him, and even the public knows his name, and they don't know the names of that many directors.
He had a run... Because the run started in 1929, when 3 months before the Depression, he writes Strictly Dishonorable and makes close to $400,000 during the Depression, right? And lives well, lives like a king, everything his mom told him he would be. You know, he had this one story he would say, this one line he would say, "My mother raised me for one reason and one reason only, and that was to be a genius. And as far as I'm concerned, she's the most successful mother that has ever been on this planet." That was one of his lines.
Did you ever know anybody who knew his mother?
No.
Because by the time your mom was along, she
died
was gone.
Before my mom was born. Yeah. I think she died in 25 or 26, 7 husbands later. So
she's the subject of a book herself.
She should be a play. Somebody, if there's a female out there or somebody wants to write a play called Mary and Isadora. And it's Mary Destey and Isadora and Duncan and these two women who tore up Europe. I think they each got married at least 4 times. And then my grandma gives her the scarf and puts an end to that beautiful life. Not in a mean way. She put it on to ease the chill. She was test driving an Amel car, which is a little 3-wheeled, one wheel in the front, 2 wheels in the back, and threw the scarf over her and caught on the wheel right behind her. But my dad's run started in 1929, where he made all that money on Strictly Dishonorable, and then he was invited out to Hollywood, I think, 1932, when he sold Jesse Lasky, The Power and the Glory, and then bumped around to Universal. He went to Universal. He wrote a script for The Invisible Man. And my understanding, nobody's seen this script, but my understanding is that everything is invisible. Like he can't find his keys. He doesn't know where his glasses are. I mean. Like a comedic version of the Invisible Man. Like, imagine if he was invisible and so were his keys.
I like that.
Right? I mean, it would be hilarious. And then he ended up, I think it was 1934, he went to Paramount and did a fire. And then stayed at Paramount until 1945. So he had this, I don't know, like a 16-year run. In the Chateaubriand of it was these 7 back-to-back number one movies making an incredible amount of money, 3 Academy Award nominations, an Academy Award I'm going to show you in a couple of seconds. I'll show it to you right now, as a matter of fact. Leave the mic on.
Okay.
And people can hear your reaction.
I'll practice my gasps.
So the BBC reporters, they would say, I'm sitting at a table in Manhattan. They have to give us the...
Right in front of me in Manhattan Beach on a kitchen table is Preston Sturges' Oscar for writing the original screenplay of The Great McGinty. So I can hold it like this, and my hand is exactly where Preston Sturges' hand held this statue.
By the way, this is the first... this is the first award ever given in this category of Best Original Screenplay.
Wow.
So previous to this, the Best Original Screenplay could either have been adapted or original, and then they broke it into the two categories. And this is the first year of the Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, I don't know that... Yeah, it says first award on the...
That's what they
on
mean.
On the back, yeah. I'm very poor on my Academy Award history. So I did not realize when they split that up.
Yeah.
But this is...
And he's standing on a little reel of film. I think now he stands on 5 reels of film. But in those days, though, they were more modest, and he only stands on one. And I believe this is the... I think it's like the... Maybe the 80th or 81st Oscar ever given. Because it didn't start much before this.
Yeah.
And they were doing like 4 Oscars... The first year, it was actor, actress, director, and movie.
Yeah, this is what, 12 years in?
Yeah.
Something like that?
So 39, I think it was the 1939 awards. And apparently what he did is, and tells the same story, is he had put in case he won it, which was going to such a long shot, he said, if I win, say that I'm not here and I'm sent someone up to accept in my case. And he gets some phonus, balonus name. It might have even been Ratsky Watsky. And when the audience found out that it wasn't the writer who was actually picking up the award, they didn't care anyway, and they ignored him. So he's up there in front of the Oscars playing out this terrible ruse that, you know, Preston Sturges wasn't here tonight, so he sent me up here. Instead of just going, hey, it was me, he wrote that he slunk back to his seat, ignored by everyone.
All that and didn't even get a laugh?
All that for a laugh and nothing. So that might have been the last time he tried to tell a joke. That might have been.
Oh, man.
But this is stars in Sullivan's Travels,
mm-hmm.
when the two film executives, that amazing scene at the front.
But with a little sex in it.
Yeah, with a little sex in it. But this Oscar sits in that scene as well.
Wow. I can feel the Hollywood history emanating from it.
I had one guy, because there's a couple things I've done with it. I think that's a good luck charm. Like a talisman in some way. And there was an actor who came over here a few years ago, brought by a friend of a friend, like very distant, but had heard about this Oscar. And he was having a very, very hard time with his career. And I said, you know, this is a good luck charm. And if you'd like, I'm happy to let you hold it. And so the guy takes it. And the moment it touched his hand, he started like hyperventilating. It was eerie. And he starts and starts weeping.
Wow!
Right. The bottom. I wish I could tell you it's Johnny Depp, but it wasn't. It was another actor who has gone on to have a remarkable amount of success. Our story stays private, but.
Wow.
And what I also do is I give that Oscar. There's a school about 3 blocks from here called the Grandview Elementary School, and every 5th grader has won this Oscar in the Grandview Oscars for the last 15 years, and they have to get up and thank.
Oh, that's terrific.
In front of all their other 5th grade students and thank each other, and I'd like to thank my agent, and I'd like to thank the Academy.
Well, since I've held it, I'm
You're
counting on a career upturn, which is
well, you have a check too. So.
Really behind the schedule. So,
my career upturn is really Behind schedule.
Yes, you sent me a canceled check written by your dad on my birthday, June 10th. Not the year of my birth, but my birthday.
I do that.
And it is a treasured possession of mine to have an actual Preston Sturges autograph on a check.
I've probably given out
a check for like $5, I think.
Yeah, so, yeah, he was cash. It was the ATM.
Yeah.
A lot of those. And, I mean, there's one, I've got a check downstairs that he wrote to Jesse Lasky for $10. So it's got my dad's signature on the front and Jesse Lasky's signature on the back. And it was like for $10. And you could see my dad scratch. Oh, hey, can I write you a check? You got any cash? I mean, what was he buying? That he just,
lunch.
What was he just, you know, kept giving his money away. So.
Yeah.
So what I have done is when I meet extraordinary fans of my father, such as yourself, you were brought to me by a friend of mine named Scott James, who heard your blog and heard you going on and on about my dad. He said, you got to reach out to this guy. And so I was happy to do it. And like I said, I've probably done it 19 or 20 times, but not to anybody who's ever asked, but only where I'll bump into somebody. And it's like that scene in the Woody Allen film where Marshall McLuhan steps out of line and starts talking to person. Uh-huh. It's like if I'll overhear somebody going on and on about my dad, and I'll wait till they're done, of course. And I say, well, you know, why this and why that? And I was getting interviewed for a job to go run a school a few years ago, and there were two deans were sitting and interviewing me. One was the head of music, and one was the head of film. And the film lady, whose name I don't have at my fingertips, was so not into this interview process. So she's lying on the sofa. She's just like, oh, God, if I hear one more question. And the music dean is doing all the right things and asking the right questions. And I was talking about how when you're running a school, you're in the legacy business, and you have to take care of not only it's the legacy of the school that's showing up through the new students who are graduating every year. And I said, and I've been in the legacy business for the last, 25 years because of all the work I've done for my dad. Film dean lying on the sofa with her hands over her closed eyes goes, well, not Preston Sturges. And, I said, well, as a matter of fact, yes, Preston Sturges. And you would have thought that she had gotten plugged by a cattle prod, that she jumped up from that sofa. And the next 10 minutes were probably 10 of my favorite minutes of being on the planet. Because here is a woman, African-American, educated, erudite, brilliant, thought-provoking. And she gives me and the other music dean a lecture on Preston Sturges down to, and this is, and he did this, and he had 38 black people with speaking parts in one film, in Sullivan's Travels. Nobody had ever done that before. He get this and that, and so not only from that perspective, but just this perspective of his great filmmaking and everything else. And I was weeping at the end. I was like, wow, this is very, very touching. And I said, you know what I do for people like you as a way of showing my appreciation and respect is I get you a check from your birthday. So what is your birthday? She looks at me. She goes, February 29th.
A challenge.
Oh, no, no. So we have a good laugh. I go back and I find one check.
Wow.
I have about 3,000 of them. And I find one check from February 29th. Immediately FedEx it back to her. Thank you very much. She sends me back a letter of a corner of her apartment, and it's got an ancient royal typewriter, probably from the 20s and 30s, and then a check of my dad's right up above it, like her little ancient literary corner. So,
I think I'm going to have mine framed with a picture of him. I think that's the way to go.
Absolutely. So, and if you can get it close to the time, but I'm going to show you when we leave. I have a couple letters downstairs of other interesting people. That, and somehow the fact that that piece of paper intersected the life of somebody you admire. I would fall over if I got a check, a John Lennon check or a Paul McCartney check.
Oh, sure.
You know, it would just...
Oh, you and me both, brother.
Right. So if his son ever decides to do what I do and go, hey, for my dad's biggest fans, here's what I do. Or like, let's say Charlie Chaplin's son found his a bunch of his dad's old checks. And if Charlie Matthau listens to this blog, you know, there's Mr. Matthau's checks, if you know what I'm saying. Because they're needless from an estate standpoint. They would just sit in a vault at UCLA.
Sure.
So why not give them away? So if I could use that as a point of transition.
Let's do that.
I've got a book reading coming up at Book Soup, and hopefully before your blog
publishes. Let me ask you about that so it'll sound natural.
Okay. talk about a ham-fisted transition.
No. I was about to ask you a little bit about your career, but let's go straight to the book.
Have you asked everything you wanted to ask about?
I will never be through talking to you about Preston Sturges, but let's.
So this will be part one.
And someday.
We'll revisit.
Yes.
You know where I live. Come on and revisit if there's another festival or something else.
I'd love to do that.
Part two.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm just sketching.
We can do five parts.
Oh.
Now, you, in addition, you started out to be a musician, right? And then became a music executive?
I was going to be a composer and conductor. And I was studying both of those at UCLA. And you look so good, man. I got to get a picture of you for people wonder what I can see. Here's what I see. This is good. And I might post this on my website also. There you go. And it was one of those moments. My brother calls it a clong, which is a sudden rush of to the heart where you realize you're in the wrong place doing the wrong thing. And I'm sure all of us have experienced that, whether you're, you know. And mine happened while I was doing graduate work at UCLA, and one of my professors told me that it was never going to happen with me as a conductor. I just didn't have the requisite skills. And I said, what requisite skill are you referring to, sir? And he says, well, the great conductors can reach over to the first chair violinist, take the Stradivarius out of his hands, and say to the clarinet player, I want it to sound like this. And play that on the violin, hand the Stradivarius back to the first chair, and say, let's go, everybody. He said, you're never going to be able to do that. You might as well stop now. And I was walking back to my yellow cab, which is how I was paying for my education, and I saw a little board on the opportunities. It's called the Opportunities Board at UCLA, and they had put up a little sign that said, Arista Music Publishing is looking for interns. And it had, you know those where they people cut the bottom
sure.
of a piece of paper, so there are lots of little tabs. So I took the whole sheet, as you would. And I called up and got a job as an intern. A month later, the lady I was interning for, a secretary, she resigned. I took her job for $270 a week. And then a couple weeks after that, Clive Davis walks by.
Wow.
And I'm like, Mr. Davis, and he's carrying his own briefcase, you know, he's in the height of his career. I introduce myself. We chat for a minute. He says, if you ever hear any great songs, please send them to me. And from that moment forward, I pitched him song after song after song and became very, very close friends with him. He and his family met me and my first wife on our honeymoon. I mean, they sailed their boat over into Antigua to have champagne with us. So in many ways, a dad I never had, as well as an older brother. I mean, just like a super cool,
wow,
super cool, wonderful, wonderful man. But that was the start of my career. And when I was there, and I think what I've done is I've had a hit everywhere I worked. So there's some memory of me in every. And the hit I had for them is I gave Huey Lewis and the News a song called Heart and Soul, which was written by Mike Chapman and Nicky Chin, which became a life changer for them and gave them a lot of radio exposure. By the way, they were amazing. They had had a song out called Do You Believe in Love that should have been a bigger hit, but then they had the song Heart and Soul, and it's been a hit for them forever. And I moved to a company called Screen Gems EMI, and suddenly surrounded by some of the most amazing songwriters I'd ever heard of, including Carole King and Jerry Goffin.
Wow.
And Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, whose copyrights they owned. And while I was there, I signed a song called We Belong by Eric Lowen and Dan Navarro. And much to their dismay, many years later, I took 100% of the copyright and for life of copyright, which is the deals we did back then. You know, I'm not going to apologize too much. The next day, I gave the song to a gentleman named Ron Fair, who gave it to Neil Giraldo, who came up with a great arrangement for his wife, Pat Benatar. It's a top five single for her in the U.S. and all over the world. And then by that time, I had now done two great things for Chrysalis. So the chairman of Chrysalis was in Los Angeles and lost the head of his publishing company. And Ron Fair brought me in for an interview. And there I was at the Beverly Hills Hotel in the lobby. And in those days, before cell phones, they would have a guy walk around with a blackboard and your name on it with little bells. So if you got a phone call, they would walk through and go, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Johnson. So knowing that I was having a meeting at there, I had the guy scratch my name. So as I'm meeting with Chris Wright and Jeff Aldrich and Ron Fair, a little guy walks by, Mr. Sturgis, Mr. Sturgis. Yes, right here. And they hand you your message. It was classic. But I took that job, and I started working for them, and I started a different part of my career, namely signing writers and artists. And I signed Outkast. I started an African American. I started a black music division, and hired a woman named LaRonda Sutton, who was amazing. And she brought in Kipper Jones and Outkast and Goody Mob, and gave us a whole slew of hits in that area. And I also signed Smashing Pumpkins and Tripping Daisy and Green Jelly and Slaughter. And had a really, really great run. And during that time, I gave Clive a song called I Knew You Were Waiting For Me by George Michael and Aretha Franklin. And it gave Aretha her 14th Grammy for vocal. And then I went and ran Shaquille O'Neal's label for a couple of years, Twism Records. And It was a very, very interesting experience. It was a clash of cultures in many ways, but I was good at saying no to people, so they would send me all the troubled individuals who wouldn't take no for an answer, and so they would find themselves on the phone with me. And I'd be like, no, I'm sorry, I don't have floor seats for you. I'm so sorry. It's just not going to happen, darling. And then I went to Universal Music Publishing. I was head of creative and executive vice president. I stayed there for 12 years, signed, again, a great, great group of signings. I signed Three Doors Down, signed the Foo Fighters, signed 50 Cent, courtesy of my assistant, Corey Bergen, whose brother was at a frat party and heard this record and said, this is the greatest I've ever heard. And we tracked 50 down and got him signed. And the last hit I had over there was a group called Owl City, and they had a song called Fireflies, which is a worldwide number one record. So
amazing.
I just summed up 30 years in three sentences. It took longer than I've just said.
I could sum up my last 30 years in less than that, believe me. One disappointment, then followed by a failure, then.
Well, I've had a great run. It turns out that I have a couple of interesting skills that fit into the music business, and that's number one, that I can hear a hit. And I've heard hit songs and acquired a lot of hit songs. Sometimes acquiring just, that's the only hit that person is ever going to have, which is unfortunate, but that's, you know, the way some people go. And one of those is a writer named Vanessa Carlton, who I wish she would have another hit. She's super talented, amazing performer and writer, but did write one monster hit. Ba-da-ba-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Now, how did you start this mentor program? Because I was very taken with this documentary with this group of kids that you helped steer through a choral group for many years. So
I was working for Twism, and Shaq had been invited to a group home for Christmas. And we decided to change the event, and Shaq's manager, Leonard Armato, had the event at his house. And one little girl who's there walks up to me and she says, my name is Helen. One day I'm going to be president of the United States. And I was like, what? Are you who here? And I found out who she was with, and it was the principal of her school, a woman named Regina Boutte. I said, here's my business card. I don't know who this girl is, but she's great and amazing, and you should have me down and talk at your school. So I get a call and she invites me down, and suddenly I'm sitting there in front of, I don't know, maybe 40 kids, roughly 7th and 8th grade, inner city. I am very white anyway, but they, you know, blue-eyed, it was just, they were like, who are you? And I start talking about music and how music is a great field of study and a great thing. And I said to them, as a matter of fact, I said, you know what, we could all, just this group of us, we could all write a song together and pitch it to Beyonce if you wanted to. And they were like, get out of here, let's do it, come on, let's do it. And I said, okay, well, let's start right now, bring me a piano. So they roll a piano, and I said, okay, so what's a nice big thing that we can start with? And a girl says, Love is Everywhere. And I was like, fantastic. That's the title of our song, Love is Everywhere. And I came up with a little chorus, Love is Everywhere, Love is Everywhere. Little thing, and they all start humming it, and it sounds very ghoulish and beautiful. And I'm like, we so great. And this one girl, what is her real name? Oh, I wish I could remember her real name. But she had her boyfriend's name on a big gold chain. Like it was like Hector or something like this. And I was looking at her, and she's very tough, very vato, very blah, blah. And I was like, hey, Hector, what do you think of the song so far? And she goes, my name is not Hector. My name is, oh, and I forget her name. Oh, she's going to kill me. She goes, my name is not Hector. My name is whatever her real name is. And I'm sorry, darling, that I remember. And I said, well, listen, as long as you're wearing a license plate that says Hector on it, I'm calling you Hector. This is the first time we've met. And she goes like this, and she takes it, throws it down. She goes, my name is so-and-so. And I was like, well, it's very nice to meet you. And that sort of won over 95% of the kids. And the story of Scheherazade, the woman who never told the ending. So she always got invited back because the king liked to kill his wives. So I never finished. So I went back a couple of weeks later, and we kept the song going. A couple of weeks later, we kept the song going. And then it turned out that the California Mentoring Initiative was having their big conference in Disneyland. So suddenly that we had a purpose. And we went and recorded the song and did a version of it. So now they've got so many other events in their life. It's not just, okay, I'm going to school and I'm going home. It's like, when is Tom coming? And, oh, we have a rehearsal. Oh, we have a practice. What's a green room? How are we getting there? So we end up taking a bus down to Orange County for the California Mentoring Initiative. Colin Powell is in the audience. Michael Eisner is in the audience. Governor Pete Wilson is in. I mean, it was like a big deal. This is a big initiative. And they invite us up as an example of mentoring me. And there's a filmmaker and a bunch of people taking pictures and everything. Nonetheless, these 37 kids, for the first time in anybody's life, were shown such complete respect by the world in such a rich and beautiful way, because they finished the song, and the audience of probably 1,300 people rises to their feet and gives these kids a standing ovation. Now, we had practiced singing, we had practiced bowing afterwards, we had not practiced this, because it was so, so unexpected. And so they're all looking over at me, and I'm like, I gotta bow? And so we end up bowing like a bunch of times, but the moment for these kids, so that was the first of 56 different times we all gathered together and went out and sang. And every year we wrote a different song. So by the time these seventh graders were graduating from high school, we put out an album of all the songs we had written together, and hopeful songs, Love is Everywhere. The message of all the songs were that there was a better place. You know, if I had 2 minutes, here's what I'd tell the world. You know, these kind of songs. We sang at the Democratic National Convention. And we sang three times another generation of that choir, because they graduated. And I went back to the school and started another choir with another group of kids, another 54 of them. And that choir continued the same tradition and ended up singing for President Obama three different times. Wow. on a song that we wrote together. Forgive me, all you Republicans. A song we wrote for him called "I Just Want to Shine Like Barack Obama Shines." Now, previously, it had been "I Just Want to Shine Like Mayor Villaraigosa Shines."
Yeah.
And before that, it had been "I Just Want to Shine Like Howard Lappin Shines, the principal." So it was a song that had these two words that you could slot in anybody. And the interesting thing in the chorus is that when we say the song is "I Just Want to Shine Like Hector Shines," and Hector waves his hand and waves to the audience, "I Want to Shine Like Maria," and Maria waves her hand. So it's in the song, 12 kids get shout-outs.
Yeah.
But then at the end, there's this "Just Want to Shine Like Barack Obama Shines." Really was a spectacular moment.
Amazing. Now,
89, sorry to interrupt myself, sure. And you. So far, I have personally mentored 89 of these kids. 88 and 89 graduated from the high school, Fauchet Learning Center, last June. And so far, that might be the end of it for the moment. But there's 89 beautiful little souls out in the world. One is in prison. And I'm sorry about that. But he got into a bad situation, and I write about him in my book. I wrote about him, called "Liar Liar" was the name of that story. And a few of them haven't graduated from college yet, but for the most part, we've got a beautiful group. 28 or 29 have gone on to graduate school. I think it's 11 or 12 have gone on to professional school. So there's a doctor, there's a pharmacist, there's a couple of dentists. And these are kids from hard scrabble lives. This
sure.
is mom is cleaning people's houses, dad's running a mow and blow, nobody's getting home till 7 o'clock at night, and they are putting together wonderful lives and rewarding their parents. And you know, one of the partners was USC. USC does this thing called the Neighborhood Academic Initiative with schools in their neighborhood. If these kids get a certain GPA and get a certain score on their SATs, they get a ride at USC. And so a lot of my kids made it into that program.
That's an amazing legacy. It really is impressive. How do people get the documentary? First, give me the title of it.
It's called Witness to a Dream, and it's a film by Reginald Brown, who wrote it and put it together and followed us around all these years, made a really, really remarkable film. The only thing I wish we had done is, and I got talked out of it, is I wish we had a narrator. Because we went sort of artsy, like let the story tell itself. So if you love that kind of movie, it tells itself beautifully through the six chapters as you see these kids. But
it's really touching to see the kids at 12 and then at 20 and so forth. I mean,
right.
It's a really moving picture. You
know? Well, I'm trying to stay in touch with them. I think it's a healthy thing. One of my boys is at West Point.
Wow.
And I've given him, there in my second book, I talk a lot about big dreams and the importance of big dreams. So when he was going off to West Point, I was like, kid, you have the opportunity because you're going to come from a position of such trust that you're going to have the ability to have a really, really big dream, and I want to give you what your big dream is. And he was like, what's that? I said, I want you to get out of West Point. I want you to do your service, and then I want you to come back and be the head of the FBI and bring honor and respect to that position as a kid from inner city Los Angeles who fought every battle to get himself here. He's got a big scar on his face, Carlos. But to come back and be that sort, and he's like, love that dream. So we got a big dream that we're working on, and I wanted to give you an example, the level to which this mentoring and how much these kids let me into their lives, only because my partner at the school, Regina Boutte, was amazing. She was like the mother hen, and whenever we go anywhere, she'd be taking them all with her, and then they show up and meet me, and I'm like, well, why are you wearing that, and why are you two holding hands? You're not having a romance. No, we're not, no romance. And I gave these girls, you know, the most important thing for inner city girls is don't get pregnant, right? There's two rules about the inner city. Number one, they never get out of the inner city because there's no money to get out of the inner city with, number one. And number two, if you get pregnant the rest of your life, you have no options. So I would remind them of this. Like even the first time I met them where the girl, it's not Carla, the girl who had her boyfriend's name on her chest. But I would say, okay, oh, by the way, there's one more thing. None of us are getting pregnant. right? Where it ends all the other dreams if you get pregnant. Okay, so no pregnancies. Okay, so when we were about to go on stage at Orange County and sing in front of all those very important people, and there's a big curtain behind us, and you could hear the bustle of the thing, I said to them, "Oh, listen, as long as I have your attention, just one more thing: no pregnancies." So this became like a standard message, and I said to them, if there's a boy who's pushing on you to do this, and you don't want to do it, and you're having a hard time, have him call me. Here's my phone number. And I'll tell you what, if he can convince me that it's a good idea that you and he should be getting together like that, then I will let you know. But in the meanwhile, it will end all your other dreams, so let's not, and so none of my girls got pregnant.
Incredible.
None of my girls got pregnant, which is a huge, this is a huge, okay, the other story. There was a little girl named Jordan, and this illustrated to me, this experience illustrated the gulf between inner city, rest of the world. And not that it means to have a wall around it, but sometimes it happens. So we're singing at an event in Westwood, and we're on the top of some building, and it's lots of ladies who lunch, and they paid $500, and we were the entertainment. And there's a small group of us, maybe 20 of the kids and me. And I stand on the side of the stage and shake everybody's hand and thank them for their, you know, singing for us, everything else. And this little girl named Jordan, she comes up to me and she says, "You know what?" I said, "What?" She said, "They put lemons in the water." And it was such a huge gulf that existed between her and that was the big deal. That I was like, they do. Fantastic, huh, for the taste. I mean, it's like, you know, they wear seatbelts. And you're like, no, yeah. Everybody wears seatbelts. It's okay, you know, I mean.
Sure.
And I stayed in touch with her. I'm trying to stay in touch with her. A couple of them, a lot of these kids got into USC, a bunch got into UCLA, and a couple got into Berkeley, like I said, this kid at West Point. But thank you for bringing that up. I love that I did that, and I hopefully changed some of these little lives. And I remember there was a Vietnamese boy, this is the level, how deep the mentoring goes, whose name was Dung Tran. And I was like, okay, I got to ask you a question. Do you know what your first name means here? And he says, and I was like, okay, if nobody told you this, your name means poop. And I understand that in Vietnam, it's probably a respectful and you're named after somebody and everything else, but you are giving yourself an impediment to a beautiful life if you walk in and your first name means poop. So I'm afraid you're going to have to change your name. Can you imagine your mentor saying that? And he said, all right, I'll think about it. And I said, okay, fine. And by the time he graduated, his name was David Tran.
Wow.
And which is fine. And now he's a pharmacist. I think he's getting married and having a kid. I mean, he's off to have a beautiful life. He might have had it anyway, but I saw my role as the mentor to smooth a rough edge, make life that much simpler, that much easier to have a great life. And off you go.
Now, you have a book signing coming up.
Funny you should mention that.
Well, I just seem to recall it for some reason. It's going to be at Book Soup?
There's two book signings coming up. The first, I'm assuming a lot of your listeners are Hollywood-bound or in that area. So
they're all over the known universe.
Fantastic. Do you have those little push pins that you can...
yes, signing, I have four of them.
Four push pins. Signing is September 26th at 7 o'clock, Friday night at Book Soup. And I'm going to be reading some of the book and might do some examples and performances of creativity. And then for everybody who's a fan of my dad, I'm going to raffle off two of these sign checks.
Terrific.
So if you buy a book, you get a raffle ticket. It's very easy to own a piece of history, folks. So easy. And what I'm also going to offer is if the person wants to and they want me to try and find one from their birthday, they can come down and trade that check for one from their birthday.
Excellent.
Does it get any better than that?
It does not get any better than that.
Okay, book signing is here in Manhattan Beach at a place called Pages, and that's October 2nd, also at 7 p.m., and I will also raffle off one check at the Pages event, because I don't think it'll be as many people, because it's hard to get people out. But we'll see.
Well, tell me a little bit about the book before we finish up.
Thank you.
It's called Every Idea is a Good Idea.
Every Idea is a Good Idea.
Boy, you don't know me. You do not know me.
This isn't to say you haven't had your disasters. I'm giving you one of my business disasters as we speak, the incredible backfall.
This is going to be cherished at my house.
Oh, yeah. This is a direct link. Well, what I've done is I have identified several repeatable, dependable ways to add creativity and innovation to your thought process. And I've done this by observing songwriters and musicians and what they do to enjoy their best creativity. And the tricks, not the tricks, but and the methods and the manners and the protocols that they enjoy that I in turn give to my readers. That's part one. So here's what I saw through one of my writer's eyes, how Dr. Dre achieves his great creativity. Here's Jerry Goffin and my own personal experience with him and how he achieved his greatest creativity. Here's Carole King. I can't speak for any of these people because nobody can speak for somebody else like that. But when I was just starting out, she sought my input on a song. Me, with no hits, no portfolio, no reputation, and her already having put out Tapestry and a bunch of those hits and one of the greatest songwriters in the world, and sought my input on something. And in fact, you responded to it. And I never forgot that. I didn't know I was going to write a book about creativity, but I never forgot that one of the great songwriters ever wasn't afraid to go to some kid and go, hey, what do you think? I focus on Elton John. I talk about Paul McCartney. And I did an amazing interview with Sir George Martin. And he talked about... And the essay is called Sir George Martin on How the Early Beatles Wrote. And it was like looking through somebody else's telescope to an image that still existed. It was such an amazing conversation. And what he talked about was how they came at each other with such complete respect for each other's work, and that they made these two promises to each other. One of them that everybody knows, which is that both names would always appear on every song. Right? That was just part of the deal. John Lennon and Paul McCartney on every single song. So even though Paul is the acknowledged writer of Yesterday, every word, and same with Eleanor Rigby and so many other songs, they say both names and they both share. So that was one example. The other thing that they agreed, according to Sir George Martin, was that they would never criticize each other's work. Never stand in judgment of each other. And if they didn't like what one of them had done, that they would just make the next section better. And I thought that was such an illuminating and extraordinary treaty to make between collaborators, that we just won't criticize each other. And imagine working on a script with somebody, and as opposed to cringing every time your partner goes, okay, let's see what we got now, you know that they can't, if they don't have a better line, that they can't say anything.
Sure.
Right? If you don't like what I wrote, you got to write a better line, and if you don't have a better line, then you have to shut up. I mean, so that's one of the ideas in the book, that anybody who's collaborating can turn to their collaborator and go, okay, I want to try something. Let's not criticize each other, because it makes me defensive and nervous, and it inhibits my creativity, and this book says that the Beatles didn't do it, so let's us not do it. Let's collaborate better than that. And if I can come up with a better line, I'm coming up, and if I can't, I'm shutting up. That's just one example, right? And Carole King, seek creative input from whomever as another. That's one section of the book. I also talked about creativity in time, in history. And I wrote an essay that I presented at the Aspen Ideas Festival a couple of years ago called Beethoven Couldn't Play the Violin. And this is such a beautiful truth to me about creativity, that here you have one of the great composers who ever lived and will ever have lived, Beethoven, writing for an instrument that he cannot himself play.
Sure.
Yet he changes the way that instrument is played by writing so much music for it and putting such a reliance in his orchestral works of it, and as a cornerstone of his obviously of his string quartets and all his chamber music. Yet all the research I could find is he was terrible. And the people were writing, and one of the quotes somebody had was, "This is really, this is truly dreadful music making," because he wouldn't play the fingers right, but because he knew it was an important part, he would play it louder. And then he started losing his hearing in his very early 30s. So you can't play the violin without ears. So that's what that essay said. So. The takeaway is, let's say that in your mind you see beautiful women in little black dresses, and you see it, and the fact that you will never fit in that dress, so what? Right? Frank Lloyd Wright never built a single house. Dreamed up some of the greatest houses
sure.
anybody ever thought of, but never built one. He left that to other people. I don't think Frank Gehry's a builder either. Although, you know, I can't say that, so I'm vamping. But the point of that essay, relying on this Beethoven concept, is that if you want to create, create. Right? Screenwriters are, generally speaking, not great actors. Right? They're great screenwriters. My dad's an example. He never starred in one of his films. Right? And not until, like, the late 50s did somebody even put him in another movie. Why? Because he couldn't act. But boy, could he write, and wow, could he direct.
Sure.
So
nobody better.
Thank you. And so that shouldn't be an inhibitory place, is the fact that you can't do it yourself should not prevent you from creating for it. That's just one of the takeaways. And I talk a little bit about this. The first creators, the first human creators, we believe, are the earliest to be discovered, created these works in the caves of Lascaux in southern France. And what they did is they found these flat spaces, this huge cavern, and over many generations drew the stories of their lives on the walls of these caves. And if the wall protruded into the room and it was kind of that shape, they would turn that into an animal. And most of the pictures are of the animals they caught. And one or two of themselves, but the real beauty in these caves is in a room called the Great Hall of the Bulls. And I wrote about this because this is the first time man had an opportunity to create, to preserve, to recognize his own work and say, "Hey, I was here." And what does he do with that opportunity? He tells a story. And my belief is that storytelling is an aspect of creativity. Almost, a picture's worth 1,000 words. That's why people paint, because they're trying to get those 1,000 words in just the way a guy's holding his hand. Man mit dem Goldhelm by Rembrandt. Tell me that isn't 1,000 words, for instance. Any of the Picasso, anything by Picasso, tell me that isn't 1,000 words. Oh, shoot, I just lost my train of thought. Pull me back. Come on, Frank. Where were we?
We were talking about creativity. We were talking about the source
third
of...
time. Oh, yeah, sorry. Caves of Lascaux.
Yeah.
My problem. And by the way, I lose my place, so you don't edit that out. That's that's me. I just did lose my place, and I found it again. So there they were in the Great Hall of the Bulls, and what does it do? It tells the story of these prehistoric men finding a herd of bulls, capturing them, running them into some giant cul-de-sac, slaughtering them, and then feasting on their bodies afterwards. That's told in a narrative across the walls of this thing. Astonishing. So what's the takeaway? What do you care about that for? Because that is our natural instinct, to tell stories, right? Fiction. They get their own list on the New York Times best-selling list. They only review fiction books, basically. You know, what's the Man Booker Prize and this prize and that prize? It's for fiction. It's for storytelling. The first thing we ever did, we're still doing it. The encouragement being, allow that story to come out. That is an aspect of your creativity, even if it's you writing in your diary or you writing the story of your life or your own autobiography. Or, you know, there's a thing my dad said. Somebody had written him a letter about how do I become a writer. And he said this to them. He said, if you want to be a writer, start with the most interesting story you've ever heard and tell that story.
Excellent advice. Excellent advice. Well, I wish you nothing but good luck with this book. I hope that a million people turn up and
I want it to
and
be,
buy
I want
it.
These, I want the sheriffs up there with there with sawhorses and
trying to
flares.
Control the crowd.
Yes, I need flares in front of the in front of Book Soup.
Well, listen, once this podcast gets out, just all bets are off.
Let's get it. And I'm going to link to my if that's okay with you, as soon as you publish, I'll link to my on my Facebook and my Twitter. I have a lot of Twitter followers.
Well, great. We will do that. We'll hit them all, and I will put links to your books and, of course, to your dad's films on the website.
Thank you so much.
So people will be able to click through and click through Amazon through my page so I can get some kickback.
Yeah, absolutely. Take as much kickback as you like.
And so I really appreciate this, Tom. This has been so much fun for me.
So let's call this part one.
We'll call this part one.
This is Preston Sturges part one.
We'll definitely do it again.
And happy to do it again, and we can talk about other things.
Yeah, I admire your dad above almost anybody else in terms of the American cinema. I've never written about him because I've always been afraid to, because I've never felt I was really up to it. So
until today.
But I admire him so much, and so this has been enormous fun for me, and I appreciate it very much.
So in conclusion, I want to just say thank you to you, and I so love when people love my dad, and the chance that I can sit here with you and show you that respect back, the respect that you show him, perfect, exactly as it should be. So thank you so much for including me, and I hope it was a great day for you, and I hope all your listeners get a couple of laughs, maybe, if we said anything funny, I don't remember, but certainly get a little insight into my dad and me and what we're all
I
about.
I think there's plenty there, and I'm going to go home and watch the Palm Beach Story. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I sure hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tom Sturges, and I hope that you will seek out his book. If you're in the L.A. area or the Manhattan Beach area, you can check out his book signings coming up this week and in the following week. He gave you the dates within the body of the podcast, but I'll also link something on the website so that you can know when and where and how. Maybe you'll win the raffle and get one of Preston Sturges' checks. That is a very cool possession of mine, the one he gave me, dated on my birthday, so it's a real treasure. So thanks to Tom Sturges for this terrific time. Really loved being down in Manhattan Beach. It was so cool on such a horribly hot day, and it was nice just being there. I hope to go back again because there's lots more Preston Sturges we can talk about. In addition to Tom Sturges, let me thank my wife, Claire McCullough, my announcer on the commentary track and on Radio Movies. And for those fans of Radio Movies who are starting to get really angry with me, this has been a bad month in many ways, and it's just a miracle that I've been able to get commentary tracks out. And I've just been thrown behind on Radio Movies. But there'll be one coming around the mountain this week. I promise you that. And I hope that as the fall goes on that I will be much more regular with those. You know, I do this absolutely and strictly by myself. That's that's not an excuse. That's just a reason. I have to go and record the interviews, then I have to bring them back and edit them, and then I have to fix up the website, and then I have to get all the links, and it takes a good deal of time to do one of these things. Again, not complaining, just explaining what's going on. It always drives me crazy with jealousy when I'm listening to other podcasts and they talk about their producers and the people in the booth recording, and that I just presume that somebody else is editing and mixing and all that stuff. Me? I'm just like Buster Keaton in the dream sequence of the Playhouse. I seem to be the whole show. So I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire, for doing two of the jobs on both of these podcasts. And thanks, of course, to James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Thanks also to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music. And thank you for spreading the word, for putting nice reviews on iTunes, for hitting the donate button on occasion and sending a little money my way so that I can slowly work my way up to the semi-bottom of this bottomless pit of debt. And I'm not going to say the podcast drains me that much, but it does. It costs money and doesn't make money. So all help is much appreciated. And you can help also just by clicking on the Amazon link and going through and buying things on Amazon through my website, thecommentarytrack.com, because I'll get a little bit back from Amazon, and that means everybody's happy. So do that if you would. And if you can't, just spread the word. Go to Facebook, go to Twitter, go to, I'm not quite sure what Reddit is, but go to Reddit, go to everything, and tell people they should be listening to this podcast, and sooner or later, you'll tell two friends, and they'll tell two friends, and then you'll all be shampooing. It'll be great. So we've got another great one coming up for you next time. A radio movie's coming up later in the week. So stay tuned for those. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.